When exactly were you at Wacky?
I want to say that I came to Wacky in 1960, and my departure date has got to be like 67, probably. But I did other things within Lynn Broadcasting. I was there. I know I was at Wacky from 60 through 66. Then I may have gone down to Nashville because they were toying with the idea of having a group PD. And I went down and was whatever they wanted to call their first group PD. Then that kind of switched around, and they decided they were going to buy WIL AM and FM in St. Louis. And I went out and became the manager of the FM station. Tom Perryman was the manager of an all-news AM, which going up against KMOX was like the most foolish thing in the world. And we had all said this, but they weren't listening. And the FM station was the only mono FM in St. Louis. I mean, you know, if you really wanted to hear the music, why would you listen to us? And then I went back for, oh, a matter of months, and I want to say this had to be probably late 67. I went back and worked, did some projects for Joel Thrope, and from there left and went to work for Harvey Hudson as the program director of WLEE in Richmond, Virginia. And we went from 4th to 1st, and I was offered a job to go to MEX in Boston. And although I loved it and had a great time, it was the greatest mistake I ever made, because I got up there, and he had two or three PDs at the same time.
This must be Max Richmond.
Yes.
Tell us about Max. What was Max like?
Max was a very brusque, but yet very tender and very shrewd businessman. The radio station was in an old theater distribution building, so they had screening rooms all through the building. He was really way ahead of his time. He had made all of his money, I think, from the stock market, and he decided that I knew too much about business and that I really should work as an advisor in his stock portfolio. And I knew nothing about it. I just read the newspaper a lot. So then when I had an opportunity to leave there and come to Florida, that's when I did it.
Let's talk about where you were before you were at Wacky.
I'm one of the guys that came through the Texas chain. I started when I was in college at KGKO in Dallas, and that was in the Cliff Towers Hotel. And I worked like midnight till 6, and that was when they did the old Lucky Buck promotion. And my job from midnight till 6 was to play records, and I read the winning numbers. The numbers they used during the rest of the day weren't worth a damn, but the winning numbers were done overnight. And so that was my first job in radio. Then I went into the service, and when I got out of the service, I went to work for a station in Tyler, Texas, KDOK, and that's where I first met Rusty Reynolds. And I stayed at KDOK for probably 8 or 9 months and was offered a job to go to KOKE in Austin, Texas. And that had to be 1958. And KOKE was a top 40 station located in the barrio of Austin, Texas. The Blue Sky Bar was next door to us, and that was a Mexican cat house. So if you ever wanted to know when there was crime or anything, it was usually a murder that took place at the Blue Sky Bar. So you didn't have to have a news department. You just walked out the door and you could cover the news. And the station was very successful because that was the era of Richie Valens and La Bamba. And of course, boy, they thought we were the greatest guys in the world because we were playing their song. From there, I had a chance to join the Don Burden organization at KICN, which was in Denver, Colorado. That was where I first learned what, you know, we know of as radio battles were all about. You had the great battle between Kissin' and Kim, the Cecil Heftel station. And it was interesting because these were the original radio wars that, you know, you guys have all been involved in later years, but that was kind of the beginning of it. Like, if you did a promotion today, they would have the same promotion on the air by 2 o'clock this afternoon. We gave away one time the Kissin' Pontiac, and we put like 1,000 lips on the car. Within 5 hours, Kim had the Kim Classy Cadillac with little Kim call letters all over their car. And so it was tit-for-tat promotion. And later, after I left there, I engaged in the same things in Wacky at KLO. Al Smith was with a radio station in Shreveport, Louisiana. KREB was going to be the Reb. So I'd left Denver, and I had been hired by the McClendon people, and I was going to go to Wacky. When I got to Dallas, I met with Gordon McClendon, and he told me that there was a station going to come into Shreveport to compete against KEEL. And he said, we need to find out what they're going to do. So he said, since nobody knows that you're coming to work for us, go over and apply for a job. So I went over, and I met Al, and they were telling me all about the station, how they were going to be the Reb, and it was going to be, you know, that Confederate thing and Confederate flags and the whole thing. They had it all lined up to go. So I got back to the hotel room, and I called Gordon. And Gordon said, well, what are you going to do about it? How can you defeat it? So I sat there for about an hour and worked on an idea, and he loved it. I said, well, what we're going to do is announce on the air, on KEEL, that the last rebel is dead. And so we did the old Stan Freberg thing. I just want to kick this off with a rebel yell. We did it every hour on the hour. And in the course of the hour, we announced that the last Reb had died. So we got ourselves a caisson. We got ourselves a pine box. We got ourselves one of those old rebel hats that Johnny Reb wore. And we literally held ourselves a little funeral for the Reb the day before they were to come on the air with the rebel. And the station never got off the ground.
I like it. That's great.
To this day, I think Al has always kind of held that against me.
Let's talk about Gordon McClendon, certainly one of the most famous names in broadcasting, especially classic Top 40 radio, and a very important part of Wacky's past. I mean, he was the guy that put Wacky on the air.
Right.
What was Gordon like?
Gordon was probably, and I say this in complete understanding of the word, Gordon was a genius. When Gordon went to Yale, Gordon majored in Asian languages. You know, that's something that a Caucasian doesn't do. And apparently he became very, very proficient at Chinese and Japanese and many different dialects of it. And all this fitted him well later in life. He was an interpreter, I think, in the military. Gordon was a dreamer. Gordon and his father both loved baseball. And when Gordon was a very young man, Gordon McClendon was doing recreated baseball, where they just sat in a studio and took the teletype ticker and recreated the baseball game. Gordon put together his own network. It was called Liberty Broadcasting. And at one time, it became as big as ABC and NBC and CBS. It was one of the biggest broadcasting networks in the country. And it was all because he did this baseball, and, you know, it was very cheap. It eventually happened that Major League Baseball filed a suit against the McClendon, saying that they didn't have the rights to recreate baseball, that they were not the licensee of the baseball game, that, you know, it was given to NBC or CBS or whoever, and that they couldn't do it anymore. Gordon's father was named Barton McClendon, and he'd made his money off of old-time movie theaters. Barton McClendon and Gordon got together one night, and Barton said, we could win this suit, but if we did, we would destroy baseball. And so they opted to lose and back off and folded the Liberty Broadcasting System. In the early 50s, Gordon was operating a popular music station in Dallas. Don Keyes worked for him kind of as a part-timer. His program director was a brilliant, brilliant guy from Boston named Bill Stewart. And Bill Stewart was the architect not only of McClendon, but he was also the architect of Todd Storrs. He worked for both of them. In the original McClendon policy memos were nothing but a series of interoffice memos from one person to another. And that's what the policy book evolved into. In that policy book, they made note that the fact that there were certain songs that people liked more than others. And so Bill Stewart and Gordon went to a teen hangout in Dallas and sat down and spent all night with just a yellow pad marking down the songs that people played. And they noticed that of the whole jukebox, which might have had 100 songs on it, only 20 to 40 songs kept getting played repeatedly. And so they checked this again for over a two-week period, and they came back and realized that if you played 40 songs that were the hit songs over and over and over again, you'd be playing what the audience wanted to hear. And that was the evolution of, quote, Top 40.
Now, working for Gordon on a day-to-day basis as his program director, what was that like?
Rarely did you really have any contact with him. Keyes is the only one that I know that really had a day-to-day contact with him.
And Don Keyes was who now?
Don Keyes was Gordon's right-hand man. He was the McClendon National Program Director. He had come up from working as a part-timer, eventually became the program director of Gordon Station KILT in Houston, then came back and became the right hand to Gordon. They owned KILT, they owned KLIF, they owned KELP at El Paso, and that was where Chuck Bloor was the program director, who subsequently went to Los Angeles and was the PD of KFWB, Color Radio in L.A., which was the forerunner to Bill Drake and Boss Radio. Now, but let me tie Gordon's Oriental languages. He bought cable in San Francisco which was a beautiful music station. It wasn't anything like his Top 40 station. Gordon used to go out to San Francisco on just, you know, his periodic visits to the station. And he would go in to the station, and he would do the newscast in all the Asian language. And those people in San Francisco thought he was the coolest thing that ever lived. Because, you know, you turn on the radio, and it's 8 o'clock now, here's the news. And Gordon would come in and go, Wong Ching, Ah, Jiao Tong King. And they thought, man, one of our guys has got a job.
All right, let's go back to Wacky. How did you get the job at Wacky?
I guess as a result of the little caper that I had done in Shreveport. They had talked to me beforehand, though, about going to Wacky.
Now, you went in as program director, right?
Yes.
Who did you replace?
They knew at the time that they were going to sell, and they didn't know who the buyer was going to be, but went in, and, you know, he said, I just want to make sure that we keep the best staff and that we have the best sound. You know, I guess the best way I could describe Wacky to you in the 1960s as opposed to the later years when you were there. In the 60s, Wacky had some zany jocks. Sanders, probably far and away, was the best. Bill Ward was a great jock, but Bill left shortly after I got there, maybe in the next year or year and a half after that. The other thing that characterized Wacky, zany jocks and Wacky promotion. And it was sort of like Fear Factor. I mean, that was what your job was about. Give you an example. Middle of the winter, January, temperatures were just bitterly cold. Jack Sanders, we put in a snake pit in a Rambler dealer in New Albany, Indiana, right under the bridge. In a three-day period, we drew 75,000 people to see Sanders in that snake pit. They were real snakes. I mean, you had real poisonous snakes. And we had an Indian, crazy Indian, by the name of Wachukanoka. And he claimed that he could read the personalities of snakes, which we never believed, but we felt that what he did was he kept the poisonous snakes on his side, and the non-poisonous were over there where Jack was. And you ended the promotion by saying that you think one of the snakes had snapped and bit Jack. And so we take Jack out, and Jack's out for about a week while he takes a vacation. The promotion was phenomenal. I mean, we're talking about a Rambler dealer. Nobody'd go to a Rambler dealer for anything. It was a huge success. We did ostrich races and camel races. In those days, did citywide figure eight races at the Jeffersonville Speedway. And KLO was there, and Wave was there, and HAS was there, and Wacky had a crowd of our guys out there. And that evolved into us also doing some oval races at the Fairgrounds Speedway out at the Fairgrounds. And we did that one year. And then one time, the sales department sold this thing that I was going to do an underwater record-setting thing at the Plantation Swimming Pool. And we built an isolation booth, like those TV isolation booths from the 60s contests, and we dropped this into the pool and pumped air into it so that you could swim into this isolation booth and stand up, and, you know, you were just in just normal air, and you could stay there as long as you wanted, and then when you came out, you'd come back out and swim up and down the pool and, you know, fool around with the people that were swimming in the pool. The only problem was that the second day, lightning hit the pool apron, and nobody told me. I heard it on the radio when I went back into the isolation booth that lightning was hitting the edge of the pool. So I get out of the pool, and there's nobody from the station there at all. So the promotion came to an end. But, you know, it was Fear Factor. Those were the kind of things that made us probably stand out. It was kind of like KRP, you know. We just did wild stuff.
Now, Jack Sanders is the name I hear most often as the premier Wacky DJ of the early 60s. And at this time, no tapes of Jack Sanders seem to exist. Can you describe what the Jack Sanders Show was all about?
Jack Sanders was a guy with a great voice. Jack Sanders was totally uninhibited. As a program director, let me explain what it was like to deal with Jack Sanders. Jack Sanders was one of those high-maintenance people. One afternoon, I walked into the control room, and there were six styrofoam cups lined around the turntable. And I said, Jack, what is that? He said, oh, it's orange juice. I ordered it from down on the corner. Well, the fact of the matter was, they were all Bloody Marys. He couldn't even tell the color difference. He had ordered the guy on the corner from the coffee shop to run over to the bar and bring him Bloody Marys instead of bringing him orange juice. And that was the kind of character he was. Jack Sanders was highly energetic. He was the jumper. He was El Kabong. He was, you know, tight, bright, just totally uninhibited. He had a charisma that he was devil may care, and everybody that listened knew he was. He also loved music, loved the bands, promoted a lot of local bands in Louisville at the time. Plus, Jack had a lot of unusual talents. One time, when Jack was running low on money, he told me he'd have to be off for a couple of days. So he went to Nashville and recorded a political jingle, then returned and proceeded to sell it around the state of Kentucky to Democrats and Republicans. In one market, the same jingle would be used for Democrats. And the next market down the road, he'd sell it to Republicans. And he turned a lot of money doing this. I've heard him on many occasions, when his newsman wasn't there, go into the top of the hour, do a station ID, and then do his own newscast, and there wasn't anybody on the face of the earth that would have known that it was the same person doing both. He could totally alter his delivery completely so that he was a different person. And he could be his own newsman if he needed to be. He did not have the benchmarks like Gilbert Gnarly and stuff that that Gary Burbank had, but he had a level of energy that was second to none. And I remember at one point in the early 60s, somebody offered him $80,000 to $100,000 to go to New York City. And Jack laughed at him. He said, I would no more move up there and try and live in that rat race for that kind of money than I would fly. And that was just the way that he looked at it. He was a super talented guy. Jerry Wood, who was one of the newsmen, he was really a very young guy, a tremendous newsman, and Jerry Wood left and became the country music correspondent for Billboard magazine in Nashville, and he was there in the 70s, maybe into the 80s.